Hi, welcome to my podcast. I'm Dr. Lauren Goodall. I'm a clinical psychologist, and this is Psychology in Short. Okay, so I came across a topic that I feel is important and is relevant. And in over my couple decades worth of working with people, this is a question that comes up a lot. And I think if I can put some bullet points to certain symptoms, certain disorders in terms of medication, when do you look at the idea of medication instead of just therapy? As a psychologist, obviously, I've been the one in the seat doing the therapy, but I've got a lot of background with medication from the standpoint of my clientele and working with patients that have medication, and obviously also coordinating with prescribers such as psychiatrists and psych nurses and such. So I think the key question for a lot of people is, you know, when do you pursue medication in mental health? And the caveat that I'm going to say is, A, I'm not a psychiatrist, which means I do not prescribe medication, okay? And B, this is from my own personal clinical caseload over a couple decades. So when I speak to something, that's what I'm speaking to. I've always had a pretty conservative idea in terms of meds, but I'm also realistic. I'm not afraid of them. I know the benefits and know when to see, hey, you know, something is going to benefit somebody versus something that becomes a liability. Never been afraid to call it. And basically, that's what you need to know. You have to know, you know, when you start doing therapy, when therapy, talk therapy, behavioral therapy, cognitive therapy, which is changing your thought patterns and understanding them, when you're not getting enough movement, that's a lot of times where you're going to start looking at medications. And in terms of being a psychologist, I've been very aware of biochemical systems, okay, neurotransmitters, and fight or flight systems in the brain. And so if you think that psychology is just talking to people, no, you really need to know how to integrate these systems. And if you do not have a good working knowledge of all of these systems, and then I'm going to say you're not going to be that effective, okay? Because you need to know when and when something needs that kind of intervention and how it should look. So anyway, with that, I think I'll just say that. You need to know when. All right, so what are some disorders and symptoms? I'm probably going to mix these back and forth a little bit, but you'll definitely understand what I'm talking about because I will take the time to describe it. Okay, tough topic, kids, okay? Oh my gosh. You want to get people really upset really fast, talk about medication with kids, but there is a case for it and there is a need for it. And I've seen so many kids get better, okay? But sometimes it requires medication management. You take steps before, you walk through different interventions, but there is a time, there is a place, and you do improve quality of life. Otherwise, who would do it, right? So let's keep that in mind. An example of that would be separation anxiety disorder. This is when you have a child who has a very, very hard time separating from you. And by that, I'm saying crying, screaming, clinging. Now, we expect some of that, especially with toddlers, and you just kind of restructure it and figure out ways and bring in people and such to kind of assist with that. Okay, but the kind that I'm talking about has, it's kind of like dialing up the volume, okay? This is, it's not that you're leaving, it's more like you're going to die when you're gone. And I'm talking about kids who haven't been exposed to, I mean, we can understand some of that if they've been exposed to a natural disaster or something really traumatic, the death of a parent, something like that. That's going to be, of course, more understandable. And I think you have more of a base to work that through. However, this particular brand, I would say, of separation anxiety is when there has been no catastrophic element that they've been exposed to, and they keep coming up with these ideas. And the parents are just like, oh my gosh, you know, where does this come from? And it's so extreme. You're going to die in a car crash. There's going to be a house fire. Just sorts of things that are just, that create so much anxiety, but also not really rooted in this child's experience or environment. And so, assuming that the environment is stable, okay, no abuse, no trauma, things like that, that's a different breed. But this is going to be something you can talk to these children all day long. It doesn't matter. You're not going to be able to infiltrate that thinking system. That thinking system is very obsessive, okay, and it's very panicked. So it's a bad combination of an obsession and a panic coming together. All right. What is going to be needed in that situation? I'm going to say you're going to want to have some medication involved, okay? And who does that? The psychiatrist or psych nurse, okay? And yes, there are pediatric psychiatrists and pediatric psych nurses, okay? And yes, why do you have to do that? Because you have to alleviate the biochemistry that's causing this child to go into fight or flight. And once you settle that down and break it down, now you could start working with them. But if you think that you're going to go do 10 sessions of talking to this kid who comes up with these profound loss theories that are traumatic and disastrous, all I can say is it's not going to work. Okay? So you're going to need to look at something like that. And like I said, not all meds are bad. There's a lot of meds that save lives, and I've seen it time and time again. Otherwise, I wouldn't even bother talking about this. So separation anxiety disorder in children, absolutely. I'm going to pick up this other childhood disorder that I'm going to say absolutely on. It's called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, DMDD. It's not just disruptive. Okay, this is about children, adolescents who go high volume and with irritability and anger. Okay, the volume is off the charts. Their temper tantrums aren't just a little bit. They are a lot of bit. Okay, when a child is that irritable and that angry, that stinks of mood disorder. Okay, that stinks of needing something to help regulate the system. Okay, and so I'll probably spend a whole other session talking about DMDD, but I call it like the early entry to a bad mood disorder. Is it treatable? Absolutely. But I do believe that in particular is going to need some medication management to take the edge off of it. And again, when we talk about medication, I'm talking about a person should look coherent. They should act coherent. They shouldn't be over the top in any way. In the sense, your child should look normal and be able to talk and communicate and be alert, that kind of thing. So that's the goal. But sometimes the behavioral structuring, the reinforcement strategies just will not cut it. So in that way, I'm going to say, hey, this is one for medication management. Okay. Let's see. Switching over to an adult diagnosis, agoraphobia. Okay. Agoraphobia is when an adult will not leave the house. And they are so stressed out that, you know, they just shut down. They have profound anxiety, but they also have profound depression. Okay. So this is where anxiety and depression come together. But what I have seen time and time again in this disorder is the people, usually are older, but not always, okay? But what they'll say is, hey, I've taken antidepressants. They don't work. For which I will say, exactly, okay? In terms of understanding medications, it's like understanding antibiotics, okay? Say you have a sinus infection and you're going to take one type of antibiotic versus a kidney infection. You're going to take another, right? So just because something falls under a certain category doesn't mean it's going to work for you, okay? But agoraphobia is an example of people who say, oh, I've tried different antidepressants, I've tried two, and I'm going to say that's a bad idea, okay? Because it's a little bit more complicated than that. And by complicated, I'm going to say that usually you're looking at something that probably is more in the mood stabilizer end to kind of calm it all down a bit better. But again, you consult with a psychiatrist. You consult about dosing, all sorts of things. But agoraphobia is generally not something that's just going to be done through talk therapy and behavioral management. So that's one that I say absolutely look at meds. Let's see. Symptoms, okay? I'm going to cover a couple symptoms of things that I'm going to say, hey, you want to look at meds. Loss of interest. When somebody loses interest in doing things, they lose all motivation. Okay. That kind of stinks of some biochemistry issue that needs to be recalibrated. I mean, granted, you can have it in death. You can have it in all sorts of grief. You can have it in breakups. But when a person gets to the point where they lose interest in most things and they just shut down, time to look at some medication. Okay, because it's going to not only be a situational event, but a biochemical event, meaning your biochemistry isn't helping you out any and it's making things worse. Another way to spot it is grooming, meaning people who don't bathe, shower. I'm not talking about once in a while. I'm talking about a regular thing. Okay, that's kind of a... it's kind of a suggestion that there's something else going on. And it's usually more in the line of depression, okay? So that's the kind of, okay? So I would definitely start thinking about if this is a regular standard thing that, hey, this person is more depressed than you think. Obsessive thinking, all right? When a person gets caught in a cycle of obsessive thinking, I don't care how seasoned you are as a clinician. It's very, very difficult, okay? It's just the brain wants to do its own thing. And usually it would happen in the negative way, which is like worry, okay? Just chronic worry, can't break it up. Or just negative types of thinking. That's just, I'll never be able to make it. I'll never be able to do it. Just one after the next, after the next. And why is obsessive thinking? You can try and intervene and talk to a person, but the problem is making it stick. Okay. You can, you know, it takes a little while to make something stick and help somebody kind of, how shall we say, reprogram the way they think. And of course, most of us, if not all of us, need some modification in the way we think about things. But obsessive thinking is a bear, okay? And the reason why I notice it out of the gate with clients is it's like the step before suicidal thinking. I've never seen suicidal thinking that didn't have obsessive thinking. Okay, so that is the pre-step before suicidal thinking. And suicidal thinking absolutely requires some medication management. Okay, so let's see. What else do we have on the docket here? Some things that don't. I'm going to say PMS doesn't necessarily require it, although we call it PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It may or may not. Sometimes people go into it very, very briefly before they cycle, and just irritability, some tearfulness, some anxiety, but usually it can kind of, you know, once the cycle starts, the hormones shift, they are okay. But you may be able to work through that without medication. Of course, severe ends of it are going to probably require something, but you can probably get by without it. Panic disorder is one that I think that you teach people how to get through panic, okay? That has to be a behavioral and a thought process thing. Behavioral is you have to teach the person how to deactivate the fight or flight, okay? Once you do that, they're going to have a skill set. You just don't throw meds at it, just to throw meds at it. And usually, you know, short-term meds like Xanax, they last a couple hours, but you're going to still have the problem again. So that's generally what you don't want to do. But panic disorder, I'm a big fan of saying, hey, make your therapy work for you and try to work through it. And, you know, because the more tools you give somebody, the more equipped they're going to be. And I'm a big fan of let's give the tools, okay? Some anxiety people can work through. People do great in cognitive behavioral therapy. Same with depression. There's certain variants that you could just do a good talk therapy with. And there's a dialectical behavioral therapy, which is also really great for people who get much more emotionally reactive. So I do recommend that one. Also, so there's different tools for different conditions. Phobias, I'm going to say, hey, you could probably work that through in good therapy. You know, it's unlikely that you're going to be exposed to everything that you're afraid of continuously. So you should have an opportune time to kind of work through that through some desensitization strategies and things like that. Oppositional defiant disorder. You know, I wouldn't look at medicating. And that is because usually that's more of a problem with authority. When you get a kid who's generally just plain defiant, you say up, they go down. You know, whatever you do, they do the opposite of. So you can always kind of plan out what they're going to do. But usually, okay, that's based on an authority problem. Kids who get ultra defiant have not been treated well by authority. By not being treated well, I'm talking about neglect. I'm talking about unreliability, okay, where the kid has to become the adult, any type of physical abuse kind of situation, and also a too permissive of a parent, when the parent just basically doesn't care, okay? The child comes to say, hey, authority does not do their job and they've never done right by me, and you generally get more of a defiant kid through authority problems. I should say not all the time, but I'm going to say you've got a defiant kid, I'd start poking my head around and saying, where's this coming from? But those are some factors to factor in. Somebody isn't reliable, somebody isn't reasonable, things like that. How to teach him proper response to authority and to respect authority. Let's see, we covered phobias, depression, anxiety, some symptoms, suicidal thinking, say absolutely, loss of interest, absolutely, obsessive thinking, absolutely, severe agitation, okay? If somebody is getting really, really agitated, and it happens, I mean, I'm talking agitated, they can't sit still, they can't eat, they can't sleep, you need to look at medication management, okay? So these are the cases for, and some that are saying, hey, you'll probably be okay. Oh, and before I close out, I want to bring in ADHD. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Certainly there's there's some disagreement on that historically, in terms of concentration problems. I'm going to speak to what I've seen and what I've seen work. Okay, and I just say why and how, etc. Here's the situation. If a child cannot concentrate, first of all, there's degrees of not being able to concentrate. You know, if it's milder, then I would pass on meds. But if you really have more of an attention deficit situation that's significant, then I would look at medication management. And, you know, I've seen parents try to do some homeopathic stuff, and I love homeopathic stuff. I really do. But certain things they just fall short on. In the mental health arena, I haven't seen too much that's been great. So natural stuff is great, but I haven't seen it work, especially in the element of ADHD. And here's why. Here's the situation. If your child cannot concentrate, that means they're not going to be able to store information. Their short-term memory is going to be shot, okay? And when your short-term memory, when you're learning, isn't storing anything, you are not learning, okay? So here you now have a problem of, you don't just have a concentration problem. Now you have a falling behind learning problem, okay? So looking at medication management to manage concentration, you're also helping them in terms of being able to store information. Because here's what it looks like. If you can't concentrate, you're very distractible, you're very impulsive. You think you're going to remember that enough to store it? No, you're not. Okay, so then stuff looks like it's new all over again, or you may not remember all the details in something, but it is going to affect learning, and that's why it does matter. Now, you know, parents do different things in terms of medication management. You know, sometimes summers they don't have them on it, and certainly makes sense. These are all the questions you can take to your psychiatrist, psych nurse, whoever's prescribing. But I do believe that a caveat of ADHD that really needs to be understood is, it is a big deal if they cannot concentrate. Do you have to factor out pluses or minuses in the medication? Absolutely. But you do want to make sure that your child can learn, okay? Because if they're not learning, they're falling behind. And when they're falling behind, that's generally a disaster in terms of their self-esteem and their self-growth. So that's why I'm a fan of saying, hey, let's try it. So again, remember, medication isn't always absolute. It can be short-term trials and just see how a person responds. But these are some disorders that I say, hey, I think it's worth collaborating with the therapy, okay? Because you need tools, okay? The idea behind medication management is to regulate the biological symptoms, okay? So that you could focus on the clinical symptoms and get better. Basically, a person doesn't get better because they've got two. They've got the biological going wild and the thought patterns going wild, and you need to be able to work with them for movement. And that's the way I've seen, you know, I've seen movement, and I've always been about movement. And if I didn't see movement with my clients, I wanted to find out why. So I believe in the tools of therapy, cognitive behavioral, dialectical behavioral. That is really good stuff too. Structure, behavior management, reinforcement management, all of that stuff is good stuff, but you better know something about biological symptoms if you're going to be talking to people. That's all I've got to say. All right, I think I made my point. If you like the way I present things, you might be interested in my book, Bipolar is Not an STD. In there, I talk about diagnoses and subtleties between diagnoses, you know, and how to make some differentiations. So I generally don't talk over people's heads, at least I like to think I don't, and I'm pretty common sense. So that's the way I roll, so to speak. So thank you for joining me. I appreciate you joining me on this cast, and I look forward to having you back. Okay, thank you.